With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Almost Famous. In the first series of the podcast, I spoke to guests who also grew up with famous family members and discussed how it had affected their journeys through life. In series two, I want to explore the subject of fame more directly by talking to people who've experienced it themselves and asking them how it has affected their own journey as well as the lives of those around them. My guest today is comedian, writer, presenter and barrister Clive Anderson. Clive got into stand-up and comedy writing while still working as a barrister and became famous as the host of Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Clive Anderson Talks Back on Channel 4, then Clive Anderson All Talk on BBC One. Clive is a regular panellist on shows such as Have I Got News For You, QI and Mock the Week, and hosts both Loose Ends and Unreliable Evidence on Radio 4. Last year, he took his first solo show, Me, Macbeth and I, to the Edinburgh Fringe and will be touring it across the UK from March this year. So a big hello to our almost famous guest today, Clive Anderson.
Hello, Barney.
Clive, that was your long intro. I will ask you about that. Before I do, I just want to say, as I always do, we're recording this from the podcast lounge in central London. And guys, if you at home are thinking, I want to do a podcast, where can I do it? Do get in touch with them. Their website is factory.uk.com. Clive, what do you think of the podcast lounge?
Nice and central and it's very comfy in here. It feels like they've just been painted and put into being.
Exactly. It's comfortable enough that hopefully we will get some guests crying. That's the dream.
That is always is.
So what do you think of your intro?
Do you want me to cry over that?
Miss anything out?
No, I think that pretty well sums it up, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah, you're happy?
Yes.
Because I was going through your business, the stuff you've done. There's so much stuff.
I thought I've done enough now to get to a podcast that isn't almost famous. I think I might almost be, over the line.
That is definitely an issue with this second series. So the first series, as I mentioned, we were interviewing people who grew up around fame.
Yeah.
And in the second series, I wanted to get a bit more deep into it. But lots of people did say, surely you need to change the name. But it's a brand, Clive.
Yes.
It's a brand.
Fair enough. Yes.
Some people suggest you could call it Almost Famous.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So I could do that. But the reality, of course, Clive, is that I've paid for a logo now and I refuse to pay for another one.
Well, for quite a while, I suppose I was almost famous, or at least I was doing bits and pieces in comedy, writing scripts, studio warm-ups and things like that. So there were friends of mine who were definitely famous, and I was, as you say, I was a barrister who sort of called in and out.
Oh, it's really interesting you brought that up, because I wanted to ask, actually, a question that I do ask everyone is, are you famous?
Well, I think I have a nice comfortable level of fame, and I was more famous a few years ago when I was more on the television, and so you're reasonably prominent if you're doing a chat show. But even then, it was only with the sort of age group that might have been watching, say, on Channel 4, as I was originally on there, then it was a bit wider, but then that rapidly, fades away. So young people wouldn't have any idea who I was. And yet people who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s get excited and they remember, remember you from Whose Line when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I have a band of fame, but not, I can walk down the street most of the time.
Okay, I kind of think of being stopped on the street as the kind of line as to whether you're famous or not.
Yeah.
So I'm interested that you brought that up. And also then you mentioned before about when you were still a barrister and getting into it then and some of your peers already having kind of jumped some steps ahead of you.
Yes.
What did that feel like then, and how did that kind of manifest itself that period of time?
Well, I thought it was quite fun, and I wasn't really, champing at the bit, thinking, that should be me. I used to write bits and pieces for Griff Rhys-Jones and Mel Smith. And I know Griff very well, so I'd often be, around with him, and he would get quite a lot of attention because he was on Not 9 o'clock News, which was the top kind of sketch comedy, topical comedy of the time. So he was good and proper famous, and then they were doing Smith and Jones, which kept them at quite a high peak. And it was quite nice being the mate of the famous person.
Is that how you got those? I mean, obviously you're a talented scriptwriter, but also it was an easier in than maybe just sending stuff out to the BBC?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think I was an okay writer. I did reasonably good stuff. But what I did do was shows that I wrote for, there's a warm-up person when you have a studio audience, and I did quite a lot of that. And I think, broadly speaking, I was better at doing that than I was at being... I think I can write some good stuff, but if you're to be a proper writer, you have to write good stuff and a lot of it, you know, on command.
And was that a natural progression because of what you'd learned from being a barrister to do warm-up, to be speaking publicly and knowing people, getting to know people, judging audiences?
There's a similarity. So I did a bit of stand-up in the early days of places like the Comedy Store, so I was reasonably... And I used to like chatting to the audience then, so that was what I was okay with. Where I thought things did mesh quite well, at least I thought so, was when I was chat show host, interviewing people on television. I had my experience of being in court, where you are asking questions, obviously, sometimes cross-examining, giving people a difficult time over something. And I'd done quite a little bit of comedy, either writing and performing. So that kind of, I thought, came together to be a good background for the work that I was doing.
And you mentioned Griff, and you met Griff at university.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Because I wanted to talk a little bit, you were the president of Footlights, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about Footlights, because the Footlights alumni is like a who's who of famous comedy writer, a comedian writer, performers of that era and many other eras as well. So yourself, Stephen Fry, Griff, John Lloyd, Douglas Adams.
Yeah.
Wanted to know whether there was a sense even back then in Footlights, a sense that maybe you're all going to become famous or at the very least successful at what you did. There was is there an inner sense of that?
Not for me, but then that may be just a lack of confidence in me. And I also sort of a lack of imagination. I couldn't quite see, because when we were doing Footlights, we had review. It was a little review and they were quite good shows, I think. But it was like there wasn't a career stretching out in front of you, that sort of entertainment. Other people, no doubt, think, oh, I'll do that and I'll make some contacts. I'll become either a producer or an actor or something. I just didn't see that. And it's a kind of double-edged sword, really, coming from a tradition of things, because you get the benefit. Footlights, I've heard of that. Oh, Peter Cook was in that. John Cleese. But then they come along and they're comparing you, a spotty 19-year-old with your first things you've written and performed, with, Peter Cook, who's a genius, or John Cleese, who by then had 20 years or whatever of performing. And they think, this isn't quite as good as that.
So that felt like pressure to you?
After I'd been there, I went back to direct a Footlight show, and I spent a happy time, which was harder in those days, digging out reviews of various people in the shows going back and finding. So the John Cleese one, so he's fairly good, but he's not as good as Peter Cook. Or there'd be, Stephen Fry hadn't come along by then. But each one compared to the...
Digging them out to make yourself feel better or for some other purpose?
It was just a funny thing to... And I found one which was of an obscure Liberal MP who'd been in Footlights saying, and he is the real deal. Right, he's the funniest thing. That was the punchline to that piece.
Well, I guess it kind of makes sense, actually, that... obviously, Footlight's going to create lots of comedians and actors, but also MPs, because they also want the attention as well.
Yeah.
Find their own way in. You mentioned your stand-up a bit.
Yeah.
I don't think many people have seen your stand-up. Certainly, I've never seen your stand-up. You mentioned that you were good with the crowd. What was your material like? What kind of stand-up were you?
Well, when sort of this sort of alternative comedy, stand-up comedy, was invented for a younger crowd.
Yeah, like Alexi Sale. That
exactly.
Kind of
Alexi Sale was the host of the Comedy Store when it started. It was in a converted strip club. It was in a strip club, which was during the week, and then at the weekend.
Still where the Comedy Store is now, right?
No, not quite. Oh, no, right. It moved around a bit. The first one was in an attractively named street called Meard Street.
Okay.
And it had a funny little lift you had to go up to be in it. And considering we were sort of aiming at... non-sexist, non-racist kind of material. The fact that, the night before there'd be, foreign businessmen sitting watching girls take their clothes off was a strange contrast. So I did that. I used to wander on looking a bit in the wrong place, as I tend to, I think, in most things in life. And so I think it was kind of encouraged, because people didn't really know what you're supposed to do with stand-up. The audience didn't really know, because they hadn't seen all of it. But there'd be, 2 o'clock in the morning, a bunch of drunks from, somewhere in North London would start shouting things out. And I quite enjoyed that. I liked the I was reasonably good at dealing with hecklers and put downs and things, which just adds to your. And if they get a laugh with a shout out, then you get a laugh at their expense. That's fine.
So, the kind of common thread seems to be that your ability to quit back to people. That's a common thread through, you know, from being a barrister to dealing with stuff early on in the comedy store, and then even then going through to your chat show hosting days.
Yes.
Really.
And in Whose Line, which is an improvisation show where there's lots.
Why was that your shtick? Why were you so good at that?
I'm too lazy to write properly or to apply. I don't think I ever come up with anything better than the first thing I think of.
Right.
Whereas if you're a proper writer, I'm sure Shakespeare didn't just come up with his play and just write it, extemporize it. He sat and sweated over it.
Well, he's coming on next week, so I'll make sure to ask. Yeah. But it's interesting. So you've talked a bit about not necessarily having the same amount of confidence as some of your peers, but then also having the confidence to say or to be confident enough in the first thing that you think to. That's a different kind of confidence, I think.
I suppose so. And I have done quite a lot of programs myself about these early days of comedy. And interestingly, I've interviewed Alexei Sale. I've asked that sort of question to him and said, did you think that the people you were performing with, some of whom, you know, became very famous, do you think everyone was going to be successful? And he just languidly said, well, I knew I would. And I didn't know about anybody else. He didn't know anything about...
With no kind of faux modesty.
No. He's like French and Saunders are performing, or Ben Elton or Paul Merton. He didn't really apply his mind too much to that. But he knew he was going to be good at. And he was a good host. He's much more comfy now and relaxed. But as a host of a noisy comedy club, he was in a suit that didn't quite fit him. He was the energy was bursting out of him. He was bursting out of his suit.
I really remember Alexei because and I think my audience know this, my stepdad Angus, who you know very well as well, was on Alexei Sale's stuff when I was growing up.
So we
had we used to watch the videos endlessly of Alexei Sale's stuff when I was far too young to mainly understand most of it, but still funny enough as a child to work it out. You mentioned a bit before about your comfort with your level of fame and a little bit about what we think fame is. I've talked about this in a few episodes before as well. I do find that some people of who were famous, say, in the 80s or 90s, I find looking from afar that some of them are still striving to reach a level of fame that they previously had. Is that anything you feel like... Yeah. Would you ever want to get back to, say, BBC One primetime chat show stuff, or do you feel like that's not your thing anymore?
When it stopped, year afterwards, 2 years, I'd have certainly happily, resumed it. But I think time has now moved on, and I'm realistic about it. I'm on. I do a chat show on Radio 4 called Loose Ends, where I'm interviewing people. So it's not that dissimilar, but it's radio. It's not television. It's not as prominent, but that's a useful add-on to a TV career that I can spin it out on radio.
And I read a few in just researching this. I read a few articles about when your BBC One chat show stopped. And it was Peter Salmon who stopped it, right? Who was commissioning editor,
the controller of BBC One.
I just wanted to, obviously, I talk a lot in this podcast about us normal people or non-famous people. I wonder how it felt or how it feels when you go through disappointments. But in the public eye, do you think there's any added level of difficulty because it's in the public eye as opposed to when I've been fired from jobs? At least it's only me. I'm not saying you were fired. I'm just saying.
No. Well, in effect, I was. But oddly enough, it didn't really become such a big public thing. Mm-hmm. I kind of expected that when it was cancelled, it might have been a bit of a story. But I don't think anybody was that interested. It happened in a rather sort of...
It's definitely on the BBC website because I saw it.
No, it was a BBC sort of way it was done as well that... They just said, we just think your show needs to be. It was quite a complicated thing that he was trying to achieve, and by the time and I had a year to do a different show.
Yeah, that's right. They moved you to a different show. What was that? What was that? Behind that?
Well, the idea was this. This is maybe a bit too boring for.
I think it's really interesting.
Peter said he wanted that they had BBC Two had Have I Got News for You, which was like their flagship show, and he wanted to come up with a show for BBC One. I was already on BBC One.
This was the early noughties, wasn't it? It was like 2002,
something like 2000. And so that's what he wanted. And it wasn't to be a chat show. It wasn't to be Have I Got News For You, but nonetheless, somebody from Have I Got News For You was to join the team because it was all done in the same production company. Mm-hmm. And we had a year to prepare it. And I was saying, I'm happy with the show I'm doing. What's the... Right. And anyway, there's a lot of extra... By the time the show actually got on, everything had gone wrong from you know, our point of view, in that Have I Got News For You had been suddenly moved from BBC Two to BBC One. So there was no longer a need for this this flagship show. Peter Sam was no longer the controller of BBC. Right. So that's often a problem. If you're trying to get a commission for a programme, the person who's interested moves on.
Yeah.
Then, so I was now doing a show which I didn't really want to be doing for a reason that no longer existed, for the controller who wasn't
in charge. Who didn't want
it. So we did one series of that and it just sort of fizzled away. So, well, can't we go back to doing the chat show that I was doing before? Oh, no, you know, the tide, the water's moved on, the river has flown through that.
Is that a good example, would you say? Because I've worked at the BBC as well and I feel like quite a lot of the stuff that happens is political in some way.
Yeah.
Quite a good example of how there are too many cooks quite a lot of the time and not a clear strategy.
I don't know. It might have been a deliberate policy as a way of getting rid of me without fuss. It might have been accidental. It may be I didn't appreciate what was going on.
Did it feel personal at all to you at the time?
I wouldn't say personal, but I felt, oh, that's a... And I mean, it's a sort of weird thing because I was quite a long, about 10 years on Channel 4. So I was quite surprised to move to BBC One in the first place.
Right.
So, oh, and that's not really like to succeed. I'm a bit not quite mass market enough for that. Then a couple of series went by. Oh, this seems... I felt settled. About four series. Yeah, there was a negotiation going on for another two series. Then suddenly it was kicked away. But I didn't then think, I know what I'll do. I'll go on to ITV because I think that would have been pushing it, you know, way too far.
Was that a possibility?
No, I mean, I didn't think it was a possibility. Right. You know, I thought that if I'd been more sort of, I don't know, more commercial, more mainstream kind of person like that, I might have had that option. But so, you know, I like to think that I have a reasonably balanced approach to life. And in a way, I was lucky to be there in the first place.
Right.
Even if I was unlucky, I think, for it to suddenly be kicked away.
I think the mechanics of a famous person's life, professional life, is actually really interesting to those of us who have no idea how these things kind of work. And it feels to me like to be swimming in the middle of it, wondering what's going to happen. Must be really interesting. You mentioned about not being sure you should move to the BBC from Channel 4.
Yeah.
Was it a risk then? Did it feel like a risk to take that and something you couldn't turn down? Or
it felt a slight of a risk. But you know, not one you want to turn down. In fact, one of the happier memories of dealing with TV executives, for complicated reasons, I was having lunch with the commissioning person from Channel 4 at the point where I knew we were going lock, stock and barrel, leaving his channel. And I was having lunch with him for other reasons. And this is unfortunate. I've got to be the one that tells him.
What?
But I had to be it's not my job to tell. But so we sat down and I said, look, before we start discussing anything further, Seamus, we've got to, I've got to say, we're moving. He said, where are you going to? And so we're going to BBC One. Oh, so fair enough. Okay, if you're going to BBC One, you've got to take that offer. Fair enough. If you said you're going to BBC Two from Channel 4, I might have been upset. Oh, let's just enjoy lunch. And
really?
And he was great about it. So Seamus Cassidy, well done here.
Yeah, big props to Seamus Cassidy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still slightly aghast that you were made to tell them that.
But it wasn't us I was made to. The natural thing would have been for somebody at
the head of the
Patrick
production
Productions,
yeah.
But as it happens, I was having lunch with him anyway, and I said, "Well, I don't mind. I think it gets it done.
Sounds like you being too nice to me, Clive, a little bit. But I'm glad it went down well. And did he pay for lunch?
I think he did. Yes, executives always pay for lunch.
Golden handshake.
There are restaurants in London I've only ever been to with. In the context of a job, which is either one you're being offered or one you're being sacked from. Either way, somebody else pays.
Well, I assume they're slightly more lavish restaurants than we would tend to go to normally.
I think they used to be lavisher in the old days.
I'm sure. Well, actually, that brings me on quite nicely to my next question. I wonder if you've talked a bit about your time before being in the entertainment industry, but as this is a podcast called Almost Famous and you've touched upon it, do you feel there's any difference in the almost famous Clive Anderson, so who you were before you became well-known on television or starting with comedy, and then who you were afterwards? Were there any kind of personality changes or changes about you?
I don't think so, but you'd probably do better asking
someone
other
else.
People who've observed me. I've only ever once... I've got a story that goes with the ever... you know that thing you say, don't you know who I am?
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell the, it's a longish story. I don't know if we've got time.
Got plenty of time, Clive.
The closest I've ever come to that it's when the high point of my career was happening. I didn't know it was the high point of my career, but it was from then on, you know, I had peaked.
Yeah.
And it involved me going to America to present the International Emmys. So it was a big awards ceremony.
Yeah.
And international means not American. So it was a third, in the big auditorium, a third were Americans who didn't know who I was. A third were people who didn't speak English as a first language, so they didn't understand what I was saying.
Okay.
But a third of them, because there's always a big contingent from Britain, a third of people I knew personally to see me. Anyway, the actual event went okay, way too long. But the next day, for complicated reasons, I sat around in a hotel reception talking to Thora Heard and Thora Heard's daughter.
Wait, where exactly was this?
This is the Hilton Hotel in New York.
Right.
Waiting for my
car. How strange, because she'd been at the ceremony as well.
She'd picking up an award,
right.
Yes. And very...
Now, you know what Thora Heard's like? Dame at this point.
No, I can't remember if she was Dame or not. But, you know, she had specialised in playing slightly dotty women, you know, northern women. And... she seemed to be comfortable in those sort of roles. So,
right.
So that was fine. And then the guy, anyway, the car picked me up late. And it's a difference between America and England. An English driver picking you up would say, we're never going to get to the airport in time for your flight. No way. Well, the American guy said, I'll get you there, don't you worry. I said, well, you know, I'm not from New York, but I can see what traffic is. It's Labor Day or something like that. And I was only doing those awards. They'd been asking me to do it for several years, but I couldn't do it because my chat show in England always was the wrong time. And I could do it because my chat show had been moved a few weeks to accommodate something else. A clear signal thing there that things weren't good.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got to the airport late, missed my flight. I'm trying to get on the next flight, British Airways flight, 2 hours later. I was queuing up with people, British people recognizing me, saying, you think you'd be able to get on the flight? So I got there, said, we've got nothing. Yeah, got nothing on this flight. And this is the closest I've ever been. So I said, is there anybody British working here? Would that make a difference? I said, I don't know. It just might do. But in the end, he didn't find anybody British. He saw it as a challenge, and he found me the seat, I'll say next to the lavatory. I think it might have even been the lavatory.
I mean, the fact that you still remember where that seat was, yes. there's a little bit of resentment there.
No, well,
still
it was
lingering.
Great to get on the flight, and that was me basically saying, surely you can find me.
That was your what you're saying is that's the closest you've come to pulling your famous card,
exactly,
basically.
Exactly. Because either people want to give you some special treatment or they don't. And if you start demanding it, then you've already
and
failed.
Other than maybe upgrades or stuff to do with flights, what kind of special treatment can famous people back when you were at your peak,
yes,
could famous people expect to get? Tables at restaurants?
You're supposed to get tables at restaurants. I remember once writing a sketch for Smith and Jones, which was based upon this idea that I can't remember how order we did it in, but you'd say Griff was trying to get a table, but he couldn't, and he got bumped off because Mel came,
right.
and then a guest star came along, and they got both of it.
Yeah.
Because what are these spare tables that are just kept in case a famous person?
I think that was then stolen in the show Extras by Ricky Gervais, because there was definitely a scene where he, playing Andy Millman, was trying to get a table, and then I think Hale and Pace came in and got a table, and that was obviously two decades after Hale and Pace were.
Well, stolen's a strong word. I think it's an interesting enough idea. Yeah.
Let's go with stolen just in case we can get any press coverage from this. Do you remember the first time you were recognised?
Ooh.
And is it a big moment in an entertainer's career?
Not really, because I came to it, if you're talking about Almost Famous, as I mentioned, I came to it sort of slowly.
Yeah.
So at university I did some shows, you know, I'd bump into people then, I suppose, but then nothing for years and years.
But that would be different. That would be different because that would be recognised because they've come and seen your show. But in terms of like by a stranger down the street, stared at in the street, that kind of thing.
I'll tell you what did happen once. Before I really got going on television, I did a sort of one-off appearance on a show. It's only London Air, London Weekend Television. Yeah. I did a little bit of stand-up on it. And the next day I was in court as a barrister and a police officer said, you were on the television. And it wasn't in my case or anything. He hadn't been told my name or anything. He said, you were on the television last night being a comedian. And I at the time, the thing that impressed me was...
How flattering.
I would call it a comedian. But also that what a good... recognizer, super recognizer, that policeman was, to see somebody completely out of context and immediately...
might make him an excellent witness.
Yes.
Might it not?
So luckily he wasn't in my case, which might not have been...
I feel like, I mean, what was it like back in the day then, doubling up on two jobs, like a two proper, you know, proper jobs? And how did it come that you made the decision to finally cut out the barrister work?
Well, I don't know if you know,
if you indeed did.
Well, barristers are self-employed in sort of private practice. So you're kind of in command of, and every time you decide to date, to do a case, you're kind of not doing all the other cases that might be coming on at the same time. So if you get in, some people get into a long, like, fraud trial that goes on for months and months and months, and they lose all their other work. So at some point, well, most of the time I was doing comedy in the evenings or weekends. Then Whose Line we were recording at the weekend, so I could still do my barristering without.
So you were still doing barrister work when you were hosting Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
And
That was such a formative show for me when I was growing up. Like like the best thing to watch on a. It was on a Friday night, wasn't it?
Yes,
like 10 o'clock on a Friday night, something like that.
Well, the best recording of that, or the best moment in doing that, my whole life came together in one slightly over 24-hour period. My wife was going to give birth to our first child. Had a bit of a false alarm one night. The next day, for some reason, I went to court in Oxford. The case got ridden off. It was a Friday, you know, turned to a guilty plea or something. Came back. I couldn't find her for a bit. And then I found her. So back in. We're up all night, she giving birth.
Yeah.
At about, I don't know, 4 a.m. or something. And then I was going to a Whose Line recording that Saturday. So I had to, obviously you have to tell people when you have a baby, but I think my first call had to be into Dan Patterson, who was the producer of Whose Line, because he, what's her cloak? It's all right, no, she's given birth. So you're arrested? Yeah. I'd had no sleep whatsoever. And then, so that's a great 24-hour period to have your first child do whatever I did in court, I mean, and be presenting a TV.
It would be
bracket.
Remiss of me not to ask what your wife thought about you fucking off to go and present a stupid TV show after giving birth.
Well,
after you gave birth.
She didn't seem too bad about it because I went back afterwards, you know, and you know, whatever you do, dabbed her.
Footballers these days take a match off.
Yeah. Well, I do. I would have missed the recording if she hadn't actually
so kindly given birth.
Yes,
before
exactly.
It
but it was such a perfectly timed. Yeah. Birthing that it fitted in with everything.
I'm interested to wonder how you think fame has changed from when you were famous to what you see famous people going through now. I guess to add to that, obviously, since the advent of social media, there's so much more...
Feedback,
not only feedback, but straight away.
Yes.
And I wonder, you know, not only to wonder how you think fame has changed, but whether if you'd have become famous now, whether it's something you would have found more difficult to deal with.
Quite possibly. I mean, I'm famous because I was on television. I mean, it sort of comes with the job. You don't have to be the best television presenter. Every television is famous. Every weatherman, weatherwoman is famous.
Yeah.
So it's not like somebody like a novelist has to work, or even an actor has to work quite hard or have a lot of success. So that's kind of easy-ish form of fame. But especially in those days when there weren't so many channels. I was on Channel 4, and then, you know, the expansion in channels has come along with me. So I think it's probably harder to be very famous. I find this when I'm interviewing people now. You can interview people that, let's say, if they're in a soap, half the country thinks is the most famous person in the world. The other half has never heard of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And there can be niche things. They're in some big success. Mm-hmm. You think, oh, here's the star of, you know, even Game of Thrones or something like that. Most people haven't seen that. It's just, so fame is sort of slightly easier in television when I was on there. But as you say, I didn't have to put up with, you just had somebody in the couple of newspapers saying, don't think much of this new bloke, or that question was poor to that guest. Mm. Nowadays, you have people piling in with their
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And do you think if you'd had to deal with that when you were on BBC One, for instance, or not had to, but do you think you'd have chosen to look at that and to try and see whether people were giving you, you know, positive feedback or the opposite?
I probably would have done. The only thing we had when I started, which made me, well, made me
point
sad,
of view.
There was a thing called a duty log.
Yeah.
And so while you're doing the programme, somebody has to be so enraged that they think, I can't stand this. And then, I don't know if you've ever tried to phone the BBC, but I don't know anybody who carries the number of them. So they're, while they're watching it, they're having to thumb through, it would have been a book in those days, a telephone or phone up directory inquiry. And then they phone in to say, I thought that ridiculous question. And you think, well, you're tempted to dismiss those people as a bit of a nutcase.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're just people who are enraged enough. It does represent, there'll be other people, if they've got the wrong end of the stick, then a lot of people got the wrong end of the stick. If there is something you did wrong in there, is somebody's opinion. So you have to multiply the person who could be bothered. But now you don't have to do that multiplication in quite the same way because you've got everybody piling
but
in.
It does sound to me like that person, actually, that you've just, you know, say we're putting a person on a whole example of people who would call the duty log.
Yeah.
That person to me sounds like the exact person who is on Twitter all the time, desperately using what they have now, which is a forum, to just slag off people. Whereas back in the day, I'm sure they existed, but you'd have to, like you said, work very hard to find the number and do it. But now they can just go for it.
Well, I would say to people, you know, let's say younger people who suffer more, I think, from this because they pay more attention. I'd say, you know, don't get too obsessed with the bad comments. There are some good comments, maybe loads more. And people aren't generally moved to just write something on, even on Twitter, to say, oh, this is fantastic. But there's a lot, there's more impetus to say, oh, I can't stand this, or this is biased, or you shouldn't have done. And people's comments aren't always, sometimes they're useful, sometimes they're just plain wrong.
Yeah.
And they're just...
I've said it before, but I think it's a lot of time, it's kind of people who are envious, you know, can't be bothered to try and do the thing that they want to do themselves and just want to get attention. I think that's really what it is.
Maybe.
That's my opinion, We talked about controversy. I think arguably you're probably most famous for the Bee Gees storming off your show.
Yeah.
What actually happened that night? Was it a surprise to you? Was there tension before? You know, what can you add?
It was a surprise because I wasn't... I have done, over the years, I have done some interviews when I've got somebody who I want to ask some difficult questions of, or I quite like a challenge. I think, how am I going to ask about such and such a thing. Whereas the Bee Gees, there were things like that, but I hadn't got anywhere near that. The time that they took exception, I think virtually every question I asked, I thought, just jollying along in what I regard as my normal way of just assuming, I assume a sort of intimacy that I didn't really have with the guests, but sort of jollying them along and making a few jokes you might amongst mates.
Light quips.
Yeah. But it is a presumption, but because I didn't know them. I hadn't met them before. I hadn't met them until they came onto the screen, onto the set to be interviewed. I was probably in a much slightly upper state than I would have been because I'd already done a whole show and they were a pre-record for the next week's show. So we had a lively audience who had, you know, they were not fever pitch exactly, but and it was a good thing to be able to say, oh, this is a good show, you've enjoyed that. And some of them knew the Bee Gees were coming on, some didn't. But either way, and here's the Bee Gees. So I was in a sort of jolly state. They appeared to be in a jolly state. So I was probably...
So you're running off the adrenaline of the previous show.
And seeing, you know, it had all gone well that so far that evening. And I asked a few questions that trampled on there. The main problem, you've mentioned I'm doing a show called Me, Macbeth, mm-hmm. and I. It's a sort of stand-up show, but I spend some time explaining how chat shows go wrong. And the main issue that I identify there, apart from my questions being wrong, is there are three of them. And if you're talking one-on-one, however annoyed you may be with the questioner or the interviewer or the interviewee, you're concentrating on each other. But if there's three of them, then you go and talk to another person. The original person is thinking, wait a minute, what did he say?
Right, they've got time to think about it.
Time to think about it and to brood a bit about it. I think that was one of them, my excuses.
and for those of those of our Almost Famous audience who haven't seen it and are now going to go off to YouTube, just before they do, what was the question that ended up them storming off on in the end?
It's a bit complicated. He didn't storm off at this point, but Barry said, I don't know, this came out of the blue. He said, well, we weren't always called the Bee Gees. I was asking about their names, and he said, oh, we're not always called the Bee Gees. We used to be called Les Tosseurs.
Oh, yeah.
And I just sort of joined in. It's a joke, obviously, and it was some, and it relates to some, you know, multiple band gig they did. Yeah.
So that's him. That's him trying to be funny.
He's being funny. Yeah. I join in. I said, "Well, no, never mind. You'll always be Tossers to me." So that sounds bad. But anyway, but he didn't walk over at that point. I was talking to Robin about something else, and I was just trampling in a period of their life when things hadn't really worked out. That things were a bit uncomfortable, and they didn't want to think about it or talk about it. Right. So that's off they went.
So once again, that was kind of your style, like quips and bouncing off your guests.
Yes.
What do you think led you to that kind of style of being a chat show host rather than, you know, trying to, you know, dig deeply into their personal lives or something like
that? Well, that's a good question. And not that all the other questions haven't been good as well.
I only hear the positives.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's usually said by interviewees who are just desperately thinking for time. So when I started, we'd done Whose Line Is It Anyway? Then we decided to do a chat show. But we had in mind, it was sort of like a parody of a chat show or improvising comedy. And we had sketches and little bits of performances. But you rapidly learn you can't do a parody chat show. You're doing a chat show. You're bringing guests on. But in the context of that, I wanted to A, be funny, and B, not avoid difficult questions. So a little bit like a current affairs interview, but also comedy. And so I more or less accidentally, I suppose, I've turned out I had a style.
Yeah.
And the more you do it, you think, well, now you feel an obligation every time you interview somebody. I've got to do that again. I've got to be... Yeah. So I tried to be as funny as possible.
Because you've grown an audience who are expecting
Exactly. Yeah. Oddly enough, when I went to the BBC, they did something called a qualitative analysis of various chat shows.
Sounds very BBC.
Yeah. So Parky was around the time, Jonathan Ross, Michael Aspel. There's quite a few of that. It was quite a big time. And I mean, it was interesting but useless research, because the things that people liked about me, the people who liked me for the same things that people disliked me. So you think you either carry on doing what you've done for your audience, or you're trying to adjust to be less aggressive or less quippy, not always trying to make a joke. So in the end, I kind of developed that on my own for a bit. Then Dan Patterson, who was my producer on that, he likes comedy as well. So I'd be sort of coming out with quips while preparing, you know, to do the interview. And he would remember them all and say, oh, you did that joke earlier on. Do you know that? So, and then a little bit of editing as well. So it became more and more concentrated. So each one had to be funnier than the last one, in my mind. And if I stand back for an hour, I think, no, I could have, you know, let off it. And now I do interviews on Loose Ends, and it's a slightly different arrangement. There isn't a studio audience, and I hope I am funny from time to time, but I don't have to be pressing the accelerator the whole time.
Yeah, you don't feel the need to be.
Yeah, a little bit like Michael Palin does those documentaries where he's around the world.
Yeah,
he's funny every now and then, but he doesn't have to be funny the whole time because he's Michael Palin.
Yeah,
you're confident that if something funny needs to be said, he'll say it at the right, but he won't do it the whole time.
Yeah, and I think audiences are really savvy to when people are trying to be too funny. Do you know what I mean? When it's not natural and not part of their persona.
Well, it is part of my persona, but I am probably trying too hard. I think I maybe I've got a bit older. And
what's clearly part of your persona is your self-deprecating nature, because you always try and cover something that comes across as funny and confident with something slightly more negative.
Well, okay, maybe.
I don't know. Busted. Busted. You mentioned giving birth to your first child instant. I wonder how...
My wife did that. Let me make it plain.
You mentioned your wife giving birth. I wonder in general how your fame affected your family. Is it something that was easy for them, they enjoyed, or did it create difficulties as well?
Well, a lot enough people kind of, if you're out, we used to go out, well, still do, but you know, go out for meals and things with people, people are less likely to come up and say something while you're en famille. I don't think they particularly liked it. But you know, it's a bit of a laugh, isn't it? When somebody comes up and says, "Oh, can you just sign my napkin or whatever it is?"
Yeah. But in keeping with what you said earlier about how you feel like you haven't changed as a person, I guess what you're saying then is that your wife doesn't think you've changed as a person either, and nor did the rest of your family.
No, I think my wife feels I should have changed, not necessarily as a result of being on television. I think that's a classic analysis of the difference between men and women. Men always want their wives to stay the same, and women always want their husbands to change.
Right.
What did she want? Disappoint.
She hoped you'd become taller. I mean, what is it she would have wanted?
Well, she can't hope for that. No. But that's not like that. But you know, probably less inclined to be joking the whole time.
Right.
I would say that's...
Growing up a bit, being more serious?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think you tread the line
and
of
I've
serious
gone,
and joking.
And I've gone, you know, if I'd have... stayed as a barrister, I'd be a judge by now. Something really serious.
Right.
And if I made a joke, at any rate, all the barristers would laugh in court, because you tend to laugh at the judges.
Yeah.
Jokes.
Now, I'm not going to mention her by name, but your daughter is pursuing a career in stand-up.
Yeah.
I wonder, because this really works well with what we did in the first series, People Who Grew Up Around Fame, I wonder if you think, from your opinion, whether you think she's pursuing that career because of growing up around your fame and career in the entertainment industry, or kind of despite what she saw and learned?
I've got three children. My wife's a doctor. I used to be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Now, all parents want their children to take on sensible careers. So you think we should have at least one doctor and maybe one lawyer. And then
all parents, including you?
Feeling? In a sort of general way. Now, none of my children have decided to become doctors or lawyers or anything remotely like that. But, of course, I've done quite a lot of telly and radio and comedy, so I suppose it's not unreasonable that at least one, and you mentioned the name Flora, has become, she does stand-up comedy and improvisation and all sorts of things. And she sees me perform from time to time, tells me, you know, where
gives
I'm going
feedback.
Right. She does. She's very good at feedback's good.
Yeah.
But I'm more hesitant of, making any suggestions to her, because I think the last thing you want is your parents saying this, that, or
yes,
the other.
I agree. I agree. And in general, do you think then you're, not just with your daughter, but do you think you've always been good at taking feedback? Is that not a lot of comedians?
No, I wouldn't say no, not necessarily. I mean, if somebody says, "Oh, look, you're favouring only one side of the room there. Be conscious, or you're moving around too much, or too." I mean, there's something simple like that. It's useful. That's because obviously somebody looking in. But with the content in the jokes, you know, well, that was a bit rude, or that was a bit rambly, or something. I suppose I might.
You can handle it.
Again, well, I did this show in Edinburgh this year, and I did have one bit of criticism which was dead useful, because I'd let a factual mistake creep into my act. And when I first wrote that, oh, goodness, how picky giving up. I did a couple of nights wrong, but then after, no, that's useful, because that's now drawn to my attention and I've corrected it. And I don't know why I'd gone wrong in the first place, but there it is.
Well, and also because people on Twitter would be right at you, Clive, if they went and they found that factual error.
Fair enough, but it's, it's a public... correction.
So we interviewed Ralph Little on this, he said in his interview at one point, and that's the first episode we put out, which has come out today, we're recording this on Friday, he said when talking about a story that actually he'd always wanted to be on QI.
All right.
And my mum listened to it today, and my mum was like, actually, I said to my mum, are there any questions you think you'd like to hear asked to people? And she said, well, actually, that really interested me, and I'd be interested to hear if there are things that people wish they'd done that they hadn't been able to do.
All right. Yes.
So I wonder if there are any things over your career that you kind of shows or things that you wanted to achieve that you haven't been able to and you still have on your list.
Oh, yes. Again, that's a good question. I've made some documentaries over the years, and I like doing those. Mm-hmm. I've just been doing some the last couple of winters for the Smithsonian Channel. But I used them on BBC Two, and I enjoyed doing those. And I wouldn't mind doing more of those, because there's a different discipline. I don't know, you know, to what extent I bring anything special to it. But though I'm just sort of treading water while I try and think. I have done QI.
Do you have ideas though? Documentaries is the first thing that came to your head. Do you have ideas of things you'd like to make documentaries on?
Yes, and I've
you pitched them heavily to various channels.
Well, the thing I would say is I mean it's I suppose in a way a sort of first world problem, but getting from an idea to getting it on screen is quite a long journey. So if you start at the beginning, there are a lot of hurdles of people to convince, and who knows, it was a good idea in the first place, but it doesn't really matter. There's too many.
Yeah.
Whereas I get the advantage from time to time that somebody else's idea has got to the end, maybe. Somebody's dropped out, or maybe they've thought of me. But either way, I'd taken to the end of the journey. So I think over the years, I've probably done more of other people's concepts in a way.
Do you feel like you're? That's a really good, interesting point, especially because I've also worked at development in the BBC, so I know exactly how the hoops section thing works. But do you feel then that you're, if you go to a commissioner, say, or a channel with an idea? Do you feel that your idea has to go through as many hoops as those of someone who's not famous, for instance?
Yeah, I think there's a slightly different issue. If you're just an ideas man or an ideas woman, or you're a producer, that's the idea can be examined. It's almost an implication if you come forward with an idea that you want to be doing it. It's an idea for me. So there's a double thing. Well, the idea's not bad, but I don't really like him, or like him, but I don't like that idea. Mm. So, I mean, these aren't... these aren't dreadful things. And as I think you've hinted, there are people with lots of ideas up and down the country. And all I would say to everybody is just, keep plugging away, because it does sometimes seem that, like, there's these people in this golden circle. But it's only because you've done one thing that you get to do the next thing.
Yeah.
And that's always the tricky bit.
Well, as you said earlier, actually, I guess one of the benefits to how TV, we're talking about TV, I guess, or TV and radio works now, is there are so many more channels, therefore there are so many more production companies. Yeah. It is hard. It is absolutely hard to get ideas into those places. But, if you keep pushing, there are
a lot more
options.
You can make a podcast. You can do on YouTube
exactly.
And oddly enough, for considering it's their job, TV executives seem only to be able to understand ideas when somebody's done them.
Yeah.
And just to be slightly happier about my career, because we're concentrating on the sort of when I used to be studio warm ups and speeches and bits and pieces. Plenty of people. Well, Mel Smith was always great. He said, "Oh, Clive, you should have your own TV program. Why are you just doing warm up?" But then, okay. And then Dan Patterson, who I've mentioned, he put me on radio and then telly.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, all these other people say, "Oh, I've got an idea for you, Clive." Producer thing. Well, where were you when I didn't have a program? Yeah. It's easy to say, now you've done it. And then I met Mel at a party, having just got going for a few years. And Mel was an unusual person. And he was very, very good as a performer, as an actor, light comic actor, comedian. But he didn't want to do that.
He became a successful director.
He wanted to be either a rock star, a sportsman, or a film director.
Yeah.
Sport, I think he'd done quite well when he was young, but that had faded away a bit. Mm. He enjoyed, as I tried to put it when I was writing, when he sadly died, he did enjoy a rock star lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was a film director, and he was, he liked being. But he was, what are we doing all this comedy on telly for? I said, wait a minute, Mel, you're the one that suggested it for me. Oh, it's a waste of time. It's so stupid, isn't it?
Well, that's easy. Him to say when he's at the top of his profession.
Yeah. But a lot of people, whatever they're doing, they want to do something else.
Yeah,
of course,
that's totally. Yeah. I see that with every comedian I know, and every even if it's a type of comedy. But what I really found interesting from what you just said is what I think is quite rare is for someone amongst your peer group to actually say, "Oh, you're really good at something you should be doing that. That doesn't happen nearly enough.
No,
I don't think.
No. Well, I mean, Mel only knew sort of slightly. I knew Griff Rhys-Jo, I still do know him much better, but he never suggested.
Yeah,
I mean, Clive, I mean, being that far.
Clive, as you know, I've worked with Griff, and but I would love to get Griff on the show at some point.
If I can name drop another person from that era, talking about, because this is about fame. A few years ago, I went away with Rowan Atkinson on sort of holidays that he kind of organised, and I remember once being at it was a castle in Scotland, and I was going up the stairs and going in, and it turned out to be quite a crowd of people there, and there's a few people saw me and they got, you know, excited, and it was kind of parents saying to the kids, "Oh, he's kind of isn't it?" Because the kids didn't know, but they got excited, and I was just thinking, yeah, wait a minute. This you ain't seen nothing yet. Because Rowan Atkinson,
Mr. Bean's about to come.
We won't need to explain to the kids. No. You'll be more excited. And I thought, this is not going to be the day you met Clive Anderson.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, my dad always said that he never wanted, whenever he was on a plane and he'd get to go business class because he was working in the music industry or whatever, and he was sat near a famous person, it would upset him because he thought if the plane goes down, no one will ever care about me.
You don't want to be the least famous person or the second most famous person.
Yeah, and I think I've told this story on an episode before, but we had a party when I was growing up that Rowan Atkinson turned up to in his Aston Martin. And me and my brother were working the car park, and he refused to park it amongst the other cars. He had to park it in the middle, like right where the actual house was, so that everyone could see it.
Oh, right. But maybe it was an insurance thing.
Or maybe he just didn't want to be told where to park his car by two 8-year-old boys.
He loves his cars.
I wonder whether after this question, we're going to do some quick fire, some more pithy answer questions.
Oh, no, that'd be harder to do. But I wonder, I'm more of a rambly person than I am a quick fire in this context.
Seeing this is talk show host to talk show host, I'll allow you to say pass anytime. You can turn it into a quiz if you want.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you can think of a time where someone used your fame to take advantage of you or to do something unpleasant. Or do you feel you've been treated pretty well in general, apart from Peter Salmon, of course?
Don't make it about him. He was just doing his job. No, I mean, the other thing I have with fame is that people confuse me with Clive James quite a lot, in quite a complicated way, because sometimes I'm in a taxi or something, and they say, "Oh, Clive, I love your programs.
Love your travel programs."
Well, and then they'll start describing a program, which is, Maria Prakatan, you used to come on there. And you think, well, at what point do I say, no, I'm not? Or somebody say, "Oh, well, please see you, Mr. James." And you think, well, if I'm just going past, do I say, no, it's actually not Mr. James? And sometimes it's just they've got the name Clive just naturally goes with James. We're not so hopelessly dissimilar.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but sometimes it's a merging of things, and they do know who I am, but they say, and of course, you're Australian, aren't you? I said, no, that's Clive James. No, you're Australian. No, I am not Australian.
Right.
The person, I'm not mixing you up. And now you're having an argument over being...
Yeah.
So everyone, I think, has got somebody like that.
When that happens, that's really interesting, because when that happens, I wonder, do you then feel uncomfortable at the thought of sticking up for yourself because you don't want to come across like a diva who's like saying, no, it's not really him, whereas sometimes it no doubt feels easier to just go along with it, like you're saying.
Well, it is. And the ones who say, oh, welcome, Mr. James, and you think, you've obviously gone to the word Clive first, or the name Clive. If you just call me Clive, then we wouldn't have
there,
but they're trying to be a bit sort of, you know... And they've gone for the wrong name.
Yeah.
And of course, Clive James has sadly died now. And I'm expecting people, it hasn't happened yet, that somebody to go, I thought you were dead. It's a different Clive.
Risen from the grave to give me my last fare in the black taxi that you're getting in. Okay, so here comes the quick fire bit, but feel free to pass. What's the most embarrassing thing that's happened to you because of being famous? You did tell us the British Airways story, but that's kind of embarrassing. A little bit embarrassing that you used the fame card. But can you think of anything embarrassing that happened apart from that?
I can't think of other than what I've just been talking about when I'm mixed up with a more famous Clive.
Fair enough. What's the best thing about being famous?
I think it just opens doors to doing other things. So if you do one TV program, you can get to do another.
Yeah.
You get invited to things.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I hope I don't swagger around too much on the basis of that.
Did you enjoy hanging out and getting to meet other famous people? Is that a common thing? Is that something that you enjoyed or you steered away from?
I would think I observed that in other people, that that famous people like there to be other famous people there.
Yeah. Do you think it makes them feel more famous?
Possibly. Just makes them feel more comfortable, as though you belong to some sort of
club.
Fame club.
Yeah.
Actually, this is good. I remember once it was at a charity event, a royal charity event. So it goes back to Griffin Mell again, but it does illustrate something about Mell, who's sadly no longer with us. But it was a big charity. I think I'd written the script. They were performing, and we were to meet, everyone was to meet Prince Charles and Lady Diana, Princess Diana, afterwards. Typically, though, Mel had something better to do
than meet Princess Diana.
Yes, he legitimately had some meeting he had to go to at 11 o'clock at night or something. Right. So I was there. I got his ticket to the backstage thing. So me and Diana, I don't think, was really enjoying the event. But then when she saw Griff, she didn't really know him, but she knew him from the telly, and she just visibly relaxed.
Wow.
There was somebody there. She could say, oh, Griff. Blah, 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 and the, so even at her level of fame, she liked having another famous person who wasn't just the Duke of somewhere, I suppose. But
ironically, that's exactly the opposite to how I was when I got in a room with Griff every time. I didn't visibly relax, that's for sure.
You need to explore your relationship Uncle Griff.
Well, exactly. We'll use it as a therapy session when he finally comes on the show. Yeah. And what's the worst thing about being famous?
The worst thing about it is when you're in, either say you're not very well in public, or you're grumpy, you're having a bad day. You think, well, if I was to, I don't know, something simple, if you just fall over, if you fall on the street, it's sort of momentarily embarrassing, but somebody may go home and say, oh, you know, somebody fell down on the street. It's not even worth talking about. Oh, do you know that bloke? He used to be on the telly quite a lot. Clive James. You know, he fell over. He was obviously drunk or something.
Well, that's where the benefit is of you being known as Clive James. Yeah. Have you seen any evidence of anything like that on the internet of people having surreptitiously taken photos of you with smartphones or any of that bollocks?
No, I don't go. I don't go on the internet very much. Mm. The closest I get is to go onto Twitter. I'm not on Twitter. But every now and then I get duped into it because somebody, usually my wife, who does for other reasons on Twitter, there's something nice about you.
Yeah.
I resisted it. I go and search Twitter and I say, oh, that's nice. And then there's 100 other things saying how rubbish I am. So I avoid doing that often.
I think I would as well. I think it's the wise thing. As a person who's experienced a lot of fame, and we've talked to quite a lot of our guests about this, a lot of people have had stories run on them in the tabloids that aren't true. I wonder if there have been any examples of those that you can think of.
There was once a while ago. It was a while ago. It was in the News of the World. And there was a story that I was going to a strip. I was a regular attendant. I think it was just a strip club, but a dodgy club of some sort. Mm. And I looked at this and I thought, well, it's not true. And what do you do about it? So this is before you could just easily tweet or write. So I wrote to the thing and said, well, would you care to correct that? Because I don't know why I was so pompous about it. But they wrote back, said, oh, in that typical sort of way, oh, I don't know why you're worried about it. It sort of adds to your allure to be...
you should be thanking us.
And I know we've checked anyway with the doorman or somebody, and you're definitely there. And so I wrote another pompous letter saying, oh, this is much more serious, because if the doorman is saying that I am turning up there, which is clearly wrong, that means somebody is passing themselves off as me, and it may have, you know, financial implications if they run up a bill. So it's very, very important you correct it. So I kept this going for a bit, and they claimed or sent me, they put a correction eventually in the paper, I think in the Newcastle edition on page 52. But it was kind of important to do that, in the sense that had it arisen years later, and they said, well, here's this story. So I had that corrected.
Yeah. But also...
Nobody was that interested, to be honest, one way or the other.
But that stuff can hurt families and stuff.
Exactly. But I was... you know, confident that it was a wrong song. I suggested to people that it might have been that they were confusing me with.
Yeah. The big thing we've learned from this episode is that Clive James visited strip bars. I think that's clear. Allegedly not true. That was a joke.
Joke, and but he's not alive, so you're free from the
legally,
laws of
okay?
defamation.
What about the estate?
Yeah, no, nobody can sue you for libel once somebody's
fine.
Dead,
stick with it then.
Yeah.
Good old Clive James. We've all been there, except for Clive Anderson, of course. Last couple of questions. Who's the most famous person in your phone, Clive? Can you think of it?
In my phone?
Yeah. Who's the most famous person you have the contact details of, do you think? Do not say Griff Rhys-Jones.
No, well, I've Tony Blair.
Very good. Yeah, Tony Blair's very good. We had Adele. We've had Tony Blair. That's pretty good. I'm going to stick with that one.
Yeah.
I actually listened to Tony Blair. Yeah. Tony Blair's audio book of his time in charge. I found it really enjoyable. There's some great stories about him and the Queen on Millennium Night, which I found hilarious.
In the O2 thing.
Yeah,
yes,
in the O2 thing.
Yeah.
Really good. But now our final question, Clive, and I ask this to everybody, knowing all that it entails and with the benefit of hindsight, would you take back the fame you had if you had the chance? Would you change it? But just to so you know, you'd have all of the trappings, like in terms of the financial and where you live and your family and everything that comes with your life as it is, but you just take away the famous element. Is that something you'd have swapped? You'd swap out.
So taking it back, putting it aside, no longer known by anybody.
Right.
Maybe have a job that generates the same amount of income.
Right.
Maybe I'm the producer or something, but nobody knows who I am.
What I've realised from this, what I've realised from doing this a few times now is that, because Rhys James did exactly the same. So I don't really understand the question. And basically, we narrowed it down to, he's like, so basically the same, except no one recognises me on the street, basically.
Okay. No, I think I'm okay with being recognised. I quite, as I've said already, I have the correct level of fame in the sense that I have enough to stroke my ego, but not so that I can't go to the end of the street and buy a pint of milk.
Brilliant. Clive, thank you so much. Just before we go, plug your show, Me, Macbeth and I. When and where can people see it?
Well, it's Me, Macbeth and I. The Macbeth element is a structure. It's largely about me, but it relates to things I've tried in life.
Are you saying that you're trying to stop people from like not wanting to come in case they don't like Shakespeare by saying...
one of the points I make is that Macbeth is the best play, but Shakespeare's the best play, therefore the best play ever written. But that's just a way of getting into a variety of things.
Right.
And I'm doing what's grandly called a tour, i.e. I've got a number of dates at distant places around the country. So not London and not Scotland, because I did a month in Edinburgh doing the show. So that was your opportunity in Scotland to see the show.
Okay, and can they find those dates on the website?
Oh, I can't give you a website here, but you easily just search me.
Google Clive Anderson.
Google Clive Anderson, you'll see me, Macbeth and I. And at the end, I know at the end it's sort of Salford and Liverpool, but before I'm down in Cornwall, Epsom.
Lovely.
Milton Keynes, you
Perfect.
Know.
There's nowhere you won't be.
Well, there's quite a few places I will.
Okay,
be,
but I mean, just as a way to exit this bit, there's nowhere Clive won't be.
I'm underprepared as far as plugging my own show, but I think I always think this when I'm, dealing with people and they want to talk about a project. That's fine. But you don't need chapter and verse these days. It's easy to find.
Clive, the loveliest famous person ever, or even slagging off his own ability to plug his show. Thanks again for coming on. Guys, please do press the subscribe button on Almost Famous. Do leave us a comment and rate us on Apple Podcasts. It would really help us. Find us on Instagram at Almost Famous Podcast and on Twitter at Pod Almost Famous. And thank you once again for listening. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.